Okay, so hi. This is a maiden voyage for both of us. I am Dahlia Lithwick from Slate.
And I'm Jan Crawford Greenberg from ABC News.
And we're very psyched to be here. Let's see if we
Which
can.
is a good word for it.
Which
Or one word.
Yes, we're both of us very, very newbies here. But so Jan, I think we're one of the first things we were going to talk about is Clarence Thomas. Let me get out my prop. His book. What do you, I know you've been working very, very hard on this story all week. What are your thoughts, both about the book and about how it's landing?
Well, you know, we got the book about 3 or 4 weeks ago because we're going to be doing these interviews with Justice Thomas. So I've read the book, I would say at least 5 or 6 times, and then really trying to get ready for the interviews, which span the course of about 7 hours over 4 days. One of the things, and I found the book was, you know, very powerful, very vivid, obviously an extraordinary life, almost unimaginable what he encountered growing up in, you know, the darkest days of the segregated South, and how he would somehow, you know, against all those odds, manage to not only get out of that, but to triumph. But some of the things I found frustrating about the book were parts where he would describe some of these experiences that he had and then not really elaborate or reflect. He would just move on to the next one. So that was something in the interviews that I was really wanted to focus on, to try to get him to talk about, you know, what that was like, or how did you navigate those worlds, or how did you respond to that situation, or why did you do that? So, yeah, I mean, in all, I just, it was obviously a fascinating portrait I found of someone who I think has long been misunderstood and mischaracterized. But what did you think?
Well, I have a review up in Slate today. I really struggled. I have to say, I mean, I read it. I only read it once. I found it very sad. I mean, deeply, deeply sad. And you know, to me, the most interesting thing about this book, and maybe I'm sort of jumping ahead a little, is the way it's been received. You know, I don't think there's a single sort of person on the political left who is persuaded, whose mind is changed about
Well, no
him.
one's listening.
Well, I mean, I think it's very, I think it's a little more complicated, and I think that what the tone he takes, you know, this very, very sort of, and I know we're going to disagree, but I think there is this tone of sort of alternating between feeling very oppressed and very, very angry. I think
No, I
it's
don't disagree with that. I mean, I think that that is the tone of the book, and it's inescapable in some parts. I think I would say that, you know, where you do see some of that, you know, I think most people say, well, you know, he's got pretty damn good reason for feeling angry about, you know, how he was treated in the South or in different parts of his life.
Well, so what do you mean when you say you said nobody's listening? What
Well,
specifically?
that was one of the things that I found actually baffling, the coverage of this book and the way it's been received. And I mean, obviously, people have wanted to talk about Anita Hill. Obviously, people have talked about, you know, kind of the angry tone that they see in the book, and that he, you know, himself admits, you know, he was trying to describe how he felt then. But I mean, even when you talk to him today, when you talk to him about race or those confirmation hearings, you see anger, you know, which I think some people say, well, that's probably understandable from his point of view. But the thing that surprises me most is that here's Clarence Thomas. He is arguably the most powerful black man in America. He has extraordinarily provocative things to say about race, about affirmative action, about programs that are working, that are not, about the debate in this country. And people instead want to and have, I mean, we saw in the New York Times yesterday, you know, they're focusing on Anita Hill. They're kind of just sneering at Thomas. I mean, we see Maureen Dowd calling, comparing him to O.J. Simpson. And, you know, kind of just moving on. I thought that that would trigger debate about race
But
and
Jan,
about programs about race, but it hasn't.
don't you think I have to disagree on this one point. I think what he has to say is provocative, certainly, but it's provocative in the same way that Ann Coulter or Rush Limbaugh are provocative. I mean, I find that his views on some of these issues are so caricatured, so stark. You know, the very notion, the very temerity of suggesting that, you know, folks in the Senate who opposed him were a lynch mob. I mean, I simply think that he had the opportunity, and here I agree with you, I think he had the opportunity to really painstakingly drill down and talk insightfully and importantly about race in America. And it seems that at every turn, he takes the sort of soundbite, the AM radio, the sort of lash out in very, very simplistic terms. And I found that not only disturbing as, oh my God, does this reflect his jurisprudence? Does he really see the world in this kind of simple terms? But I also found it deeply, deeply damaging to the court. I mean, if we want to believe, and I think you and I do believe, that the Supreme Court is above that kind of soundbite politics and soundbite ideology, my God, he set himself up for what happened in the New York Times.
Well, I think that he probably would have expected what he got in the New York Times and doesn't care what's in the New York Times. You know, and I mean, obviously some of the language that he uses is extraordinarily explosive, provocative. You know, his response when I asked him about that was, well, you know, people should be focusing on what was done to me. That was how I was feeling at the time when it was happening. And why aren't you asking questions about why people were doing this to me at that time? You know, and his point is, look, you know, I did think they were bigots. I did think they're racist. I do think people who say I just followed Antonin Scalia on the court are bigoted and racist because they're assuming these things because I'm a black man, because I have to think a certain way. And so when you put in, you know, kind of the whole story of his life coming from, you know, the deep south of Savannah, Georgia, going to all these all-white schools, the first black, growing up being the most educated person in his class when he was, I mean, in his house when he was in third grade. I mean, you know, I think all of those life experiences get him to that point where he would react the way he did in those confirmation hearings. Now, I absolutely agree with you that I think some of the way that the book was written is unfortunate in that it doesn't seem to take it past 1991. And, you know, that was 16 years ago. And, I mean, he has a lot to say and a lot he could contribute since then. I think it was a real mistake in the book to have ended it in 1991.
Well, that, on that I agree. I mean, I think it's just, you know, there was a way, if he needed to reopen the conversation about Anita Hill, and I just don't think we needed to reopen that conversation. There was a way to do it, I think, in anything, you know, less than a completely vitriolic, you know, to paint her as, you know, what did he say on CBS, that, you know, that she wasn't the sort of chaste, demure,
right, she was
conservative Christian.
And, you know, he doesn't have dialogue. I mean, look what he says about her in the book. I mean, he doesn't have kind words to say about her, but as you said, I mean, his angriest words are for the senators. You know, I mean, when you're comparing senators to, you know, Klansmen and slaveholders, I mean, it's pretty strong stuff. But I think I'll go back, you know, I've got to just go back to the point I was making earlier, which, you know, when I first read the book, you know, I mean, you know, I went through all these phases. I mean, the first time I read it, I was, you know, kind of shocked. And then the second time, you know, different things just start sinking in. And then I read all the books that he said were so influential, whether it was, you know, the autobiography of Malcolm X or Native Son or Invisible Man. You know, so you do start seeing kind of a story of this life and why he might think the things. And then with the interviews, that obviously kind of really filled out for me. And I wrote this huge piece on .com where it's mainly, ABCNews.com, it's mainly about the 7 hours of interviews we did, where he elaborates on all these things. And I do wish that there had been so much more of that in the book.
Let me ask you this question. Is your sense that the book stops in 1991 because he had to do that for sort of politic reasons, or do you have a sense that he hasn't really evolved or changed ideologically since then? I mean, one of the things he said, again, you know, not to cite the CBS interview, I know that you did one too, but one of the things he said at the very end was that sort of very growly, like, not only am I not evolving, but I'm sort of evolving backward to, you know, to what my grandfather was. And it does seem like one of the things that's very, very troubling about the book is whether it was done as a question of, you know, an aesthetic question or an ideological question or simply, you know, his own choice. He seems to have been arrested in 1991.
Well, you know, Dahlia, I think that, you know, and I think that's an impression that the book leaves because that's where it stops. I mean, it stops when he goes onto the court, which I think is really unfortunate. You know, he explained it that, you know, he didn't feel like he should really be writing about all the stuff that was going on inside the court and, you know, talking about that, and so that's why he decided to leave it in 1991. Now, in the interviews I did with him, and particularly the ones in his chambers, we had a wide-ranging conversation about the law and his views on the law and what he thinks about oral arguments and the justices he admires, and, you know, I mean, there's so many different points that he could have taken the book. And I really wished, I think for like all of our sake, you know, people who really follow the court, who find him obviously a pretty fascinating figure on that court of nine, certainly different than the other justices, you know, that I think that would have really been something worthwhile to have.
Well, so that's actually a good segue into our next topic, which is this sort of new judicial openness. and you can probably speak to that better than anyone because the justices are being open to you. But what's your sense of, I think we probably agree there's been a real sort of watershed, massive, massive change in the last couple of years in terms of justices being willing to give speeches, to give interviews, to talk openly, to write as Thomas did. What's your thought about, is this sort of netting out to the positive? Is this a bad thing? What's your sense of this project? Is it working?
You know, I've loved what you've been writing on this because in some ways, to go back to Justice Thomas, I mean, his book does have the feel of somebody just kind of walking in and sitting on the couch. Well, I'm sitting on the couch now, but, you know, just kind of bearing his soul.
Lying on the couch.
Yeah, and, yeah. We've already seen some of the criticism about how, you know, do we really want to know all this stuff? I mean, do we really want to know, you know, about our justices' personal lives? You know, I think a lot of people want to think, you know, they're just kind of up there above it all trying to figure out all these really hard problems. And so, you know, and I asked Justice Thomas about that, and he said, you know, no, I mean, I'm a human, and I'm not that. And, you know, he really feels like he wants to be able to connect with people, to show people that, you know, that he is human, and I guess by extension that there are members of the court who have had problems, who have struggled, who have gone through these things. But at the end of the day, I mean, you know, it's obviously a very different approach than just saying, well, you know, there's my life story, and it's right over there in the U.S. reports, which is the way, you know, the justices back in the day used to kind of approach the confessionals and the interviews. And look, I mean, some of the stuff, that the interviews that the justices are giving, putting the Thomas memoir off to a side, you know, it's not, you know, some of it is not that staggering. I mean, you can read their decisions and pretty much pull out a lot of the things that you're hearing.
Well, I mean, I it's so funny. You know, it's clear, you can tell from my writing, I'm absolutely conflicted about this. I mean, I was one of those people who, you know, a couple of years ago when I started covering the court, you know, I would sort of set myself on fire. You know, they're not gods. You know,
what's under the robe?
Tell us who you really are. You know, Sandra Day O'Connor used to sort of routinely go back to the well of, oh, you know, it's all in the four corners of my opinion. You just need to read my opinion. No, you know, come on, tell us who you are. And then she wrote that, you know, her autobiography, which told us pretty much nothing, and it was sort of like, okay.
But you have that picture of her going over the hill in the pickup. You know?
Right. No question. And someday, we're probably not going to have time today, but contrasting her autobiography to Thomas's is worth somebody's doctoral dissertation. But
yeah, I completely agree. I mean, yeah, okay.
No, I mean, I was just going to say, it's you know, with the speed of light, we know too much. And I don't, you know, and I don't put this solely on Thomas's memoir, because I actually felt reading Justice Stevens, the interview with Jeff Rosen in the Times Magazine, you know, again, I had that very slightly uneasy sense that he's telling us a little more than we need to know about how he games Anthony Kennedy, for instance. You know, I sort of think, and I'm just going to test this theory on you because I haven't really built it yet, but I think that there's a weird way in which the press corps is captive to some of the same sort of mythologies that both the justices and the public are captive to, which is to say, I think we're torn right down the middle on this issue of, are they doing something different? Is this beyond politics and ideology? Is this something sort of oracular and holy? Or is it just, it's Bush v. Gore, it's politics all the time? And I think that even we in the press corps are very conflicted about where we come down on that.
No, I think that's true. And it still has this feel of, well, where are we really? You know, and what do we really know? And, I mean, you know, obviously you look back at the court over the last 20, 30, 40 years, there have been a lot of colorful figures. I mean, people weren't blogging about it and doing all that, but, you know, we knew a lot about our justices back in the 60s, too. You know, I mean, look at William O. Douglas. I mean, we've had some characters up there who would have really been fun to cover, by the way. But, you know, today, I mean, it does seem like, you know, particularly because I think all of it's kind of come at the same time. You start seeing justices giving interviews, and then, of course, on the heels of the confirmation hearings of Roberts and Alito, there was more interest in the court, so people were just, when justices would have speeches or debates or whatever they were doing, I think there was just more interest in that, too. People would just start showing up. So I think, you know, it's a kind of a combination of a lot of things coming together right now. And then with this, the memoir of Justice Thomas, I mean, that really, and like you said, the Stevens piece, too, I mean, that really starts kind of fueling this, wow, new openness. I mean, maybe it is a new day.
Well, and it does, for me, sort of raise this question of, and here's me massively backpedaling and trying to thread a needle that maybe can't be thread, but threaded. But here's my question. Is there a way that the court could have been open without sort of the sort of tell-all confessional Oprah openness? In other words, I still think that the high point of openness was that debate you moderated between Justices Scalia and Breyer last year. You know, now that was podcast. We could all get on and see it if we want. But they weren't talking about like, oh, you know, here's what I think of feminists. Oh, you know, here's what I think of abortion protesters. No, it was extremely scholarly. I thought very sophisticated.
Right. Yeah, they were slugging it out over originalism and, you know, an evolving constitution and doing it in a really good-natured kind of, you know, I mean, it's weird to say, and maybe this shows that I'm a complete geek, but, you know, it was kind of funny, too.
Oh, it was great. It was great. And it was so much more, for me, illuminating. I mean, I have to say, and I know you and I come down on pretty different, you know, points of the spectrum with respect to Clarence Thomas's memoir here, but I have to say, you know, I would much rather pry open the top of a justice's brain and see the sort of clanking machinery of jurisprudential theory than see, you know, a sort of catalog of bitternesses and wrongs and slights, because to me, you know, I can't help but keep going back to that part of the book where Thomas says, you know, oh, the day his grandfather died, he was talking to a bunch of, you know, angry white women in Chicago. Well, those two things are not connected. And yet, for the rest of my life, I'm going to think, oh, I'm just an angry white woman, you know, and I don't get a fair hearing because in some weird way I'm psychologically tied to, you know, the death of his grandfather. I mean, it's I just don't want to know if he truly, truly hates liberals like me. I'd almost rather not know it.
Well, I think that it would have been really great in terms of what Justice Thomas would have done with that memoir to have seen not only the story of his life and where he came from. I mean, the first four chapters of the book, I thought, were just pretty extraordinary. I mean, you know, think about having someone like that on the Supreme Court who grew up, again, I mean, in the Jim Crow South where, you know, white kids were being taught not to even drink out of the same water fountain as a black kid. And then Thomas alone goes off to integrate these all-white schools by himself in a boarding school, going to school with these same kids. I mean, that's a part of our nation's history that I would think most people, certainly under a certain age, cannot even believe happened, much less if there's someone alive and on the court who's been through it all. So, I mean, I think he has a lot to write about and to say, and there are things certainly that we need to know. Just covering the course of his life in his own perspectives, I wished he hadn't stopped in 1991.
What did you think of the Frank Rich column yesterday?
I mean, you know, I thought that was, you know, again, I mean, I think the coverage of the book has surprised me. I told my bosses at ABC, you know, this is going to really trigger, there's going to be a huge debate about this book. There's going to be a debate about race. It's going to get injected into the presidential campaign. You know, he's saying a lot of provocative things about affirmative action and why he thinks it's just, you know, harmful. I mean, he talks a lot about race and race policy. So, you know, I was telling everybody here at ABC, you know, this is going to be a big story, race. And I think the politicians are going to have to address it. And instead, you know, we've seen, at least in the New York Times, you know, we've seen Frank Rich and Maureen Dowd just like sneering at him. I mean, Maureen Dowd, you know, comparing him to O.J. Simpson, which I find extraordinarily offensive. I mean, you might disagree with what Clarence Thomas has to say, and obviously a lot of people do. But, you know, I think, you know, let's talk about what he has to say. I mean, there's a, and as he says, a lot of the things that we're doing aren't working. So, you know, I've been surprised at the coverage because in a weird way, it's almost like it's dismissive of Clarence Thomas. Like he is something that really no one or certain segments of the media have any interest in hearing from. It's like he is an invisible man.
Well, I guess, again, you know, and I don't differ with you on the sort of brutality of the attacks, and I don't even think those are some of the worst of them. I think my problem is, and I tried to say this before, my problem is he's the one who conflated personal and ideological. He's the one who conflates throughout this book what he sees as, you know, everything that happened to him for personal reasons that largely had to do with race.
And it's clear that,
you know, and that's something that, you know, one can hope. I guess he hasn't worked it out since 1991. Maybe, you know, in the next 20 years in the court he can. But I think that if he can't unbraid, you know, what were just political or ideological attacks from what he sees as sort of personal victimization based on race, I don't think it's fair to say his critics should be forced to unbraid it. I mean, I just don't think I need to do that work for him. It seems that, and that's one of the things that to me was most frustrating about this book, is that you cannot say everybody who criticizes my ideas is a racist. Everyone who criticizes my ideas is a liberal feminist, and then not be criticized for that, and then sort of seize this mentality of, oh, you know, nobody, I get the last word on everything because I'm a victim. And I think, you know, I wrote this last week, and I really feel it strongly. This book could have been the sort of teachable moment that you're talking about. It could have been a really important opportunity for him to drill down and talk in a sort of meaningful way. And forgive me for citing to my crush on Barack Obama, but, you know, the way Barack Obama is trying to talk about race in America and say, you know, look, let's get past calling each other names. Let's get past the sort of nasty, snarly sound bites and really talk in a meaningful way. And I think he would have been better situated than anyone, Jan, to launch that conversation. He opted not to do it. He opted to just, you know, volley one more shot in what I think is a sort of AM radio war. And so it's hard for me. It's hard for me to say, oh, my expectation was that, you know, we would have a very, very nuanced, involved conversation about affirmative action. He clearly is not capable of having it.
See, I disagree with that on affirmative action. I mean, I think when you look at, you know, I mean, putting aside for a moment, you know, the way he describes the confirmation hearings and clearly, again, through the prism of race and the way he describes his opponents during those hearings. Let's just put that to the side. But when he talks about affirmative action and his experiences and how he believes that it not only is harmful to blacks, but that it diverts the attention away from more pressing problems in society, I mean, he has a lot to say about that. And I don't think that that is really of the same class, at least when he's talking about that, as some of the other criticisms that you and others have had. And some of my frustrations, too, about the book, toward, let's say, the last third of the book. Like, I mean, the stuff he talks about affirmative action, I mean, those are his experiences. And he believes that his whole life he succeeded, you know, coming from where he came from and the Jim Crow South, going on to Holy Cross, graduating ninth in his class at Holy Cross. You know, that he succeeded despite these enormous odds. And then to get to Yale Law School and then for the rest of his life be told, well, you've only gotten where you are because you're black. When in fact, where he came from, to get anywhere because you're black was just an extraordinary thing. I mean, to get out of the situation that he grew up in, being a black child in the Jim Crow South, is something that not a lot of people were able to do at that moment.
Do you agree with my read of his, you know, there's no question that the formative relationship in his life is with his grandfather. And there's no question that, you know, he sort of elevated him to sort of mythic status. And, you know, understandably, I think his grandfather literally saved him in a million ways. But it is very interesting, I think, and maybe I'm asking you this as a parent now. Did you read Bill Kristol's very, very weird sort of rave review of this book that essentially says, you know, let's hear it for his grandfather, for never hugging him, for never showing him affection. It's a very strange kind of tough love approach, and part of the reason I asked the question is that, you know, as I was reading the book, one of the things that I kept tripping on was that if there was one person who was helping more than Clarence Thomas to devalue his college degree, his Yale degree, his ascent to the Supreme Court, it was his grandfather. I mean, it really seemed like his grandfather, you know, by on some kind of unspoken principle, refusing to attend his graduations, refusing to attend his weddings, refusing to, you know, sort of see him as anything other than what's the quote, educated fool. It seems almost as though he is trapped between his own sense of having achieved things and his grandfather's sense that you can never really beat the system. Am I overreading that?
See, that's not how I saw that, because, you know, I think that, too, I mean, any time when you're reading, I mean, particularly with this book, I mean, I think you have to think about what it was like at that time and at that place. And the way that, you know, people like Myers Anderson were, I mean, that is not, I think there are a lot of people who grew up in that generation. I know, I talked to my dad about this. You know, his dad never said, I love you. I mean, that was just, you know, those kind of guys who worked the land, who weren't that educated. I mean, that was, I don't think that that's that unusual. I mean, perhaps Myers Anderson was, you know, harder than most, and he was tougher than most. But I bet if you interviewed a lot of people of Clarence Thomas's, you know, kind of socioeconomic background from that point in the South or the Midwest or wherever, they would have fathers who weren't all that dissimilar. And Myers Anderson, I mean, the way Thomas talks about him, he did expect him to be more. You know, he sent him off to those schools. He would bring him back to the local NAACP meetings that he attended every week so that Thomas would report on his grades, so that all the people there would know, you know, that they could do it if they just had the chance. So Thomas, when he was, you know, in high school, would go on Saturdays and tell them, you know, how he was doing against all these white kids and doing very well. And, you know, I mean, that's, again, I mean, if you want to talk about the psychology of all this, I mean, obviously that's a lot of pressure to put the dreams of a generation on one kid. But, you know, time, so for all of his hardness and toughness, Myers-Anderson also was, you know, giving him the message that, yeah, you can do it. I mean, and I expect you to do it, and you can't quit. So I think some of the stuff that we see from Thomas now, you can't quit, and, you know, don't shame me, some of the quotes that he uses, play the hand you're dealt, you know, obviously he got those from his grandfather at a time when they meant things. Now, I think when you look on it, I mean, we're a different generation. I mean, the dads go home and, you know, I mean, it's just inconceivable when you think about how today's generation, I mean, reading that and thinking about how the men of that generation treated their children.
So let's talk about if it's possible to write an objective book about the court. Do you think, I mean, it's very interesting to contrast the way, for instance, your book has landed with the way Jeff Toobin's book has landed, with the way Thomas's book has landed. Are we in a 5-4 world, Jan?
You know, I don't know, Dahlia. I mean, my book, it's funny. I mean, my book, you know, and I covered the similar periods that Toobin did, and I had a chapter on Thomas. I didn't set out to write, you know, that Thomas was this independent guy. I was trying to figure out why the Rehnquist Court wasn't as conservative as a lot of people thought. And in fact, Thomas ended up being a pivotal figure in that. You know, and so, you know, my book has kind of been characterized as a certain way now, particularly compared to Toobin's, as being more conservative than his. And his is more liberal. You know, and now, of course, Thomas's is, you know, I don't know how we're going to characterize that one, confessional, however you would want to describe it. But, you know, it's a funny thing about the court, because unlike, you know, when you look at the dialogue here in Washington, which is obviously so stark and divisive, I mean, I think you are seeing that now. I mean, the core is the same. You know, people are taking sides, and you're either on this side or that, and it is hard to try to just, you know, write something that, you know, like I really feel with my book, in many ways, I ended up in that kind of dangerous middle ground. You know, when you're in law school and you get stuck in that middle ground, I don't know if there is an audience for it.
Well, I think it's certainly probably. Here, I'm going to stop and do a little commercial for Theraflu because I'm quite medicated right now.
But I'd be curious. What do you think? I mean, can you? I mean, how do you? You know, let's say you're just walking the middle ground, and then, you know, I think there is this hunger for people on both sides to either, you know, say this is an outrage or this is the greatest thing ever. I think you've seen that in the coverage of Clarence Thomas. You know, you've had people on, you know, like you mentioned the Crystal piece, kind of fawning over Justice Thomas, and then you have people on the left, like Frank Rich and Maureen Dowd, saying, you know, I mean, he's a disgrace. Maureen Dowd saying he's O.J. Simpson. Why do we have to take both sides? I mean, it seems like, how do you walk that?
I think it's not possible. I really think that. And, you know, to me, that's the sort of great shame. I mean, I really do think that in the years since Bush v. Gore, the justices have, if there's one thing I think they've spoken sort of unanimously about, it's the court is different. We're not strictly political. We're not purely ideological. What we do is different. When you put on that black robe, believe us or not, something different happens. And, you know, you heard all of them who spoke publicly coming out in different ways, sort of trying to make that point. And I think, you know, with greater and lesser success, but certainly, you know, as we said, seeing a Breyer and a Scalia saying, look, here's what we do. You know, I don't just vote what you know, Karl Rove tells me to do. I don't just, you know, vote what my own ideology is. And I think they've had some degree of success persuading the people of this country that's not what they do. And there's a reason that, you know, the judiciary still polls higher than other branches of government. And so I do think that there is this thing that they do that is different, that, you know, triangulates to something different, that is fixed. And maybe that's just, you know, my wishful thinking. But I think that when we write about the court, we don't always do a great job of pointing to that. And I think, you know, and the examples I always give are, you know, why do we have to keep saying when we write about the court or any courts, you know, who was a Republican appointee and who was appointed by a Democrat? The minute we shorthand it like that, we kind of circle back to this is all politics. And there's a million ways we do that. I mean, we all wrote dozens of 5-4 conservative liberal split stories last June. And that kind of goes to what I think I was trying to say before about we are so torn, I think even we who report on the court, about our sense that, you know, this is above politics, it's something else. You know, if you sat down with me and a glass of sherry in my, you know, cushy chair and read the opinions, you would know.
Well, it would be sherry.
In my house, it's sherry. Drugstore sherry, my friend. Not to mix with the therapy. But I think that there is, we're just completely conflicted. That we on the one hand, think, of course it's 5-4. Roberts is conservative and, you know, Stevens is liberal. It's that simple and everything else is sort of smoke and mirrors. And at the same time, I think, you know, when you're talking about, look, I'm trying to be, you know, down the middle here. I'm trying to be objective. I think Tubin would have said the same. I'm really trying to call it like I see it. It's such a wonderful paradox that this is what the justices say they're doing, right? We're not taking sides. We're calling it like we see it. Here we are, one step removed. We're doing the same thing. We're just umpires, Jan. We're just calling it like we see it. And yet I think in a dozen ways, large and small, we really, really do contribute to politicizing the court.
Well, when you definitely report it, and then when you see, you know, like, for example, the editorial in the New York Times last week when they're saying, you know, these 5-4 decisions that suggest that it's all just politics, you know, when in fact, I mean, the court's been divided 5-4 for a very long time. I mean, it was 5-4 going the other way when Justice O'Connor was there. I mean, that fuels certainly the public perception. I mean, I think that as journalists, our job is to, you know, write about the decisions. And when justices talk, to ask, you know, if they're willing to talk, then you ask them questions. And, you know, when last week, 2 weeks ago, when Justice Thomas sat down with me, I had a bunch of questions about the court and what he does and how he got there. You know, I think that that is an interesting perspective to have. I mean, and then you have other people who can take it and do what they want to with it and you know, criticize it or do it however they do. But, I mean, particularly from my perspective and yours, I mean, as well, I mean, you know, I think it is still our job to say, here's what they did, here's what's important, here's the reasoning that they used. Now, of course, when you say it's 5-4 and this justice was, you know, nominated by this president, then that does suggest that someday politics may play into it. I don't think it does, and particularly when you realize that some of those justices, like Souter, like Stevens, you know, look at the presidents who nominated them. They weren't Democrats. They happen to be on the liberal side of the aisle now.
And see, this is why I think, I really think, that the single best thing we could do to sort of depoliticize the court to...
My lights are going on and off here. It's crazy. Sorry.
Your lights?
Yeah, in my office. They're just going on and off. I'm being too still. I have these motion sensors. So anyway, it's a little distracting. Sorry.
Okay, well, we'll edit that. But I think the single best thing we could do to depoliticize the court and to sort of undermine that sense that everything's 5-4 and that, you know, my own sense of the damage I think, for instance, Thomas may have done, perhaps inadvertently, I think what we need to do quick is roll the cameras in there. I think as soon as we had cameras in there and people could just fall asleep watching, you know, interstate commerce, maritime law, you know, and they could really see that the court doesn't only decide Roe v. Wade and the court doesn't only decide affirmative action. I mean, the single biggest mistake I think the Chief Justice has made, and I've written this and I've said it over and over again, is only allowing audio, live audio, contemporaneously, on the most polarizing questions. You know, give the people a chance to hear Scalia talking about something really boring day after day after day. I guarantee you it would undermine the sense that this is a 5-4 conservative liberal court. I do not understand why the court is resisting that, because it would really, really, I think, help explain this is what the court does. It's not all politics.
No, I think I all of that you've written, and I absolutely agree with you. You know, in a weird way, that audio is now kind of like the sword that's going to be used to kill the video. And I think that's a real shame because, you know, I think the court was doing that in response to a request from us. You know, we need the audio or something. And now it kind of adds to this whole thing that, look, all these cases are so divided and the court's so divisive and it's all politics. And I don't understand it. I mean, I asked Roberts, whenever I was interviewing him last year or so about cameras in the courtroom. And, you know, it doesn't look like it's going to happen. I mean, obviously, you know, Justice Souter's famous, you know, over my dead body. And Roberts said, you know, well, he doesn't want to do anything that would hasten Justice Souter's demise. So, you know, and that's fine. And, you know, read the opinions and we have the audio. But at the same time during that interview, Roberts said, and there were about 3,500 people in the audience, you know, a lot of students and professors. He said, you know, the best thing you can do is just come up and watch an argument. Well, you know, most people can't come up and watch an argument. So if that's such a great thing to do, then why not have the cameras? For those reasons, and in addition to all the other ones that you suggest to give the, you know, a better view of the court, a more complete view of the court, to, so it doesn't seem that everything is 5-4 and it's politics, politics, politics. It's also like a great civics experience to see how this branch of government works.
Right.
But, you know, it's not so easy for, you know, people just to pack up and go to Washington and stand in line and get in on the day that they happen to be having an argument.
And to add the fact that the alternative to watching oral argument being televised is watching those goddamn confirmation hearings.
Yeah.
That's as close as most Americans are going to get to the civics lesson you're talking about, is watching, you know, a bunch of puffy, puffy, puffy senators asking incredibly pompous questions with no question mark at the end. I mean, this is not the view that you want to give Americans of what happens on the court. Now, it certainly helps, I think, this is why the court's ratings are higher than the Congress, that the justices are also much smarter than the senators who are asking the questions. I think that, you know, at the end of the day, you can see Roberts sort of run circles around them, and you say, oh, okay, well, I don't know what they're ever going to do for the rest of their lives once they disappear into that marble box, but at least I'm confident, you know, they're smarter than the people who were just questioning them. But I do think that, you know, for the justices not to be aware of the profound damage that's done by the sort of 1-2 punch of the confirmation hearings, which just disgrace both the Congress and the courts, and then the sort of absolute radio silence that most Americans get from there on in. I mean, why wouldn't they think the court is polarized?
Well, not only that, I mean, you've got, I think when you think about the confirmation hearings, you look at their, right, I mean, look at how they kind of unfold, and you've got senators sitting up there, some of them just reading questions that their staffers have written for them, others actually trying to have a better dialogue. You've got the nominee himself, you know, very constrained in what he can say. But then you've got all the groups on the outside, on the left and on the right, you know, the machinery, you know, in place to either oppose or support. I mean, that, I think, you can't overstate how that, again, fuels the whole idea that it's just politics. I mean, it's not only the debate inside, it's the debate that's going on, you know, outside, on both sides.
Right. Well, and that goes back to, you know, I think the one thing that Thomas is probably unpeels in his book, and it's true, is the sort of machinery that exists, you know, to take out the nominee from the other side. You know, I think it's, I mean, on both fronts, it's merciless, and you're right. I mean, it's relentless, and it's sort of, you know, there's this very, very heartbreaking passage where he sort of describes, you'll know the words better than me, but, you know, people just racing around saying, what do you got on Clarence Thomas? What do you know? Anything that you've got on Clarence Thomas. My God, if they did that about you or me, Jan, you know, we wouldn't get out of bed in the morning.
I
mean,
it's,
that's just not a way.
Let's just not even talk about that, Daria.
So, you know, one other thing that I thought maybe would be interesting for folks is talking about, you know, you and I both sort of are emblematic of the change in the court beat. I mean, you're blogging and I'm doing whatever hybrid thing that exists between blogging and reporting. And I sort of wondered about your thoughts on, you know, do you like being a blogger? How is it
different? Well, yeah, I'll give you mine, but you have to answer this too. Because, you know, I was a newspaper reporter for 20 years, and, you know, only recently gone to TV and doing blogging, and even a conversation like this, in a weird way, and if I sound like a total freak for the first hour or how long we've been talking, I apologize, because it seems really strange. I mean, I feel like, you know, I'm supposed to be this objective reporter. I mean, I even feel strange about giving my opinion on Justice Thomas's book. You know, I mean, I write about this book, I ask him these questions, you know, I ask him questions about why he would think this way, and what about people who say this. You know, I mean, you do an interview, but it is, I think it's dangerous in some ways for reporters, particularly, you know, who, you know, I mean, working for mainstream media who don't kind of have the voice. You know, we've always been the people who are supposed to be in the background. We're not the story. You know, we're covering the story. You know, we're putting the microphone in people's faces so they can explain their views, and then we're talking to other people to say, no, this is what I think. And so I think it is like kind of this weird new world, and in a way I think it's dangerous, and it's hard when you're having these kind of casual conversations or when you're blogging. You know, I mean, to keep in mind that, look, I'm just a reporter here, and I'm just telling you, you know, here are the facts, and here's what's going on, and here's what people are saying. And my opinions, you know, don't really matter.
See, it's interesting, because I, as with all, we should call this entire segment, this entire conversation, Daya has no firm opinions on anything. I'm about to disclose that I am...
See, that's good, because you're a journalist. That's the way it's supposed to be.
I'm of two minds. No, but it's not that I'm neutral. It's that I have strong opinions in two completely different directions on this and other issues. I have very, very strong opinions that, on the one hand, suggest that the Supreme Court press corps is way too neutral. I've sort of, you know, even as recently as last week, Jan, you know, walking in and hearing everybody sort of muttering out the side of their mouth, like, oh my God, that Thomas book, here's what I would write if I were you, Dahlia. And I was like, dudes, write it! You know, like, but they can't. So there is this sort of sense that they're constrained, you know, but to my mind, it's just a very strange, you know, we have this sort of, oh, you know, we don't offer opinions, and yet if we don't, you know, who will? And so I'm for offering opinions. I don't think that it's a wise thing to cover the Supreme Court as though it's like nuclear fission. You know, it's just science, and we take ourselves out of it. At the same time, I think the single best thing about the blogosphere has been the sort of huge growth industry of, you know, opinion writing about the court.
I absolutely agree. I just think that for journalists, for daily journalists who cover a beat, whether it's the White House, whether it's Congress, whether it's the Supreme Court, whether it's the State House back in Springfield, Illinois, it's very dangerous for journalists, separate from bloggers, separate from law professors, separate from columnists. It's a very dangerous thing when journalists start giving their opinions, because journalism, daily journalism, I mean, what I've done for the last 20 years is to, again, you keep your opinions out of it.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly raises real questions about what I'm doing in there, but, you know, I think...
you're in a different position, too, you know, and I mean, I think you have really managed to kind of walk in those, in both worlds, but... You know, I think that, you know, when you're just kind of a straight, more mainstream daily journalist, it's much trickier.
Although certainly, you know, we have colleagues who are excoriated every day in the blogs for pretending to be neutral, and in fact having very, very strong political leanings that, you know, color everything. And certainly, I think, you know, the whole notion that there's no such thing as objectivity in journalism is not a new idea. It does seem as though the court is sort of the last province of still believing that we can be objective. You know, I don't know. Like I say,
I don't think that's true, though. I mean, I think that people who cover the White House, or whether they're covering Congress, or whether they're covering the FDA, or, you know, the FCC, I mean, I think that everyone, when you're doing that as a daily journalist, you're trying to be objective, you're telling both sides of the story, you know, and you're presenting that story. I mean, it's not an opinion piece. You know, in a weird way, we have gone, I think, back. I mean, it seems like we're in a position now in our business where we're really moving back to the way journalism used to be, where you had paper, you know, a million different papers, you know, people on the street corner, you know, hawking whatever paper of the afternoon was. There, you know, every town had 15 or 20 different newspapers that people could pick up, and those newspapers were partisan. You know, this whole notion of objective journalism is, you know, not something that's been around forever. So I think that in some ways, because of all these new explosions of technology and blogging, I mean, we're going back to a little different era in journalism. I'm not saying that's a bad thing. It's just different, and I think we haven't quite figured it out yet.
It does sort of circle us right back to where we started, though, Jan, which is this notion that, you know, is it then possible to ever be objective about the court? And the fact is, you know, if you read right-wing blogs and left-wing blogs after a decision comes down, you feel like you're reading about two totally different entities, you know? And I do think it sort of goes to the sort of the nature of the blogosphere anyway, and the sort of nature of the debate about the judiciary anyway. But I do worry that if you still have this filament of hope, as I clearly do, that what the court does is a little bit different than just politics, then it's awfully hard sometimes to sort of, you know, just accede to the fact that, well, we're back to the sort of, you know, partisan view of the world. Because, you know, that's when I do start to say, well, maybe it is nuclear fission. I mean, maybe there is something that the law does that this naked, you know, bare knuckles politics doesn't do, that needs to be accorded just a tiny bit of sort of deference, of and I don't mean, you know, the last argument I'm making here is, oh, you know, decorum and the court needs to be holy and sacred for its
own,
right?
This is like, I'm like, where are you coming from?
No, that's just deranged.
Wait, who is this?
That is deranged. And, you know, you hear it and you just are, you know, every time I hear that argument, I just want to laugh because, you know, the notion that if we don't have any coverage, therefore people will respect us, you know, not in this day and age. That those days are over. But I guess I do think that, you know, to sort of hear some of the bloggers or some of you know, and look, at the same time, the best, I think flat out the best writing being done about the court is being done by some of the bloggers. So as with all things, you know, it's both the best and the worst. But to hear it just so nakedly politicized, and to know that there are people who, you know, to quote Cass Sunstein, right, who have this daily me, who only ingest one side of the spectrum and only hear about, you know, the evils of the left-wing activist judges. Ooh, I don't know if that's good for the national conversation about courts and judging.
But Daya, now I think from my perspective anyway, you try to tell the story in an objective way. And I wrote this huge piece on Justice Thomas that I had mentioned earlier that we posted online. And, you know, looking at the comments, which can be very painful, but looking at the comments, you know, I had people saying that I was too hard on him and that I was a big liberal, and I had people saying this was great and I was sympathetic to him. And so, you know, at the end of the day, I guess maybe that's the suggestion that we're still doing things right. When you're either annoying people all the time or not pleasing people, you know, you get it on both sides.
Right.
Makes journalism a lonely business.
No, I think you're right. I think, you know, you always know. I always know, like, I've had a good day when my hate mail from the left and the right are about in equal proportion. But, you know, it does sort of raise these huge questions. And, you know, I think the truth of it is, you know, the Thomas book is, you know, one of those things that's really going to bring out, I mean, reader comments that are unlike, you know, I mean, there are a handful of, you know, books that sort of touch on the rawest nerves of, like, gender and race and politics. And I think, you know, I wouldn't read too much into the tea leaves of those comments because it really seems to get people unhinged on both sides of the aisle. But I think you're right. I mean, I do think that if I've sort of learned anything, it's that, you know, all you can try to do is be fair and to sort of, you know, not be ad hominem and to you know, hope that you're making people angry and about equal measure. I just wanted to ask you what you thought about, you know, ABC made the decision to talk to Anita Hill, and so did, I think, NBC, and certainly the Times gave her a spot to talk, and I guess CBS is taking a lot of heat now for what's being called the sort of infomercial where Anita Hill wasn't given a chance to respond to Justice Thomas's allegations. Do you have any thoughts about that?
You know, I don't know why CBS didn't interview her. You know, no one told us not to do that. You know, no one put any restrictions on it, and presumably they had no restrictions either. I saw that Steve Croft had told Howard Kurtz the other day that there were no restrictions and that they were focusing on a different part of the story. You know, I mean, look, he makes these allegations in the book that, you know, he believes he was treated unfairly, and so then Anita Hill is going to be given a chance to respond. Now, you know, Justice Thomas would also say, look, she's had 16 years to respond. She wrote her own book. She was on 60 Minutes in a very softball interview. You know, so this is my response to the last 16 years, so maybe she doesn't deserve a response. He didn't say that to us. I don't think he said that 60 Minutes.
Jim, this was really cool. Weird, but
maybe
we'll get better at this. I don't know. So next time, if you're on TheraFlu 2, I guarantee you this would be quite an experience.
Well, right. We can be more in sync. Or we could just have a glass of sherry.
Exactly.
And talk things over, like exactly. You suggested earlier.
Freebasing TheraFlu and sherry. But it was totally great talking to you. I let me just say for the record, you know, you and I don't always agree, but man, I think you're just... Your work is amazing.
Oh, gosh, Dahlia, thanks a lot. I feel the same way. I always read your stuff. It's great, and I'm always anxious to think, God, what's Dahlia going to have to say about that? I mean, the way you cover arguments, I mean, you really, you have taken Supreme Court coverage in such a, you know, great, great leap in the right direction.
Well,
so,
thanks.
I mean, it really, you've added so much to people's understanding of the court, and you make it accessible. And, you know, I think that's such an invaluable service. So it's great talking to you.
Well, to you,
and,
too.
You know, next time we'll have this figured out.
All right. Have a good day, Jan.
Thanks, and I'll see you in court tomorrow.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.